I was away on a, well, I wasn't, I was in London, but a conference which was, all in total, was 9 days of input from some of the big names in trauma therapy, particularly in the context of the body. So I thought that fitted rather nicely with this series, and yeah, the whole way in which under stress our body goes into quite a specific response. So the reactive body, so that's a body under stress, will respond in stereotypical ways. And those ways are actually not necessarily only human. We tend to decompensate to our more primitive bits of our brain when we are stressed. Yeah. So, yeah, this talk this evening is going to be around that reactive process in the body. But yeah, also we can play around a little bit with this idea of a creative body as well. One of the kind of statements that was kind of coming out very clearly to me, and which I've heard before. I've spent, you know, kind of the last 10 years, I guess, sort of training around the body and trauma. But yeah, again, hearing this statement that it's biology before psychology. So we have the, we might have in our minds this a sort of a model of psychology at some point segueing into spirituality. Yeah, so maybe we don't have to picture it that way. I mean, Sangharakshita makes it quite explicit. He says that that transition, that shift from the psychological into the spiritual, takes place when we move from the hindrances into dhyana. Yeah, so everything below dhyana is psychological. Anything beyond the first dhyana, he says, is spiritual. Well, maybe there are other ways to have that conversation. But yeah, maybe there's some point at which we shift out of what in the West we've come to know as a kind of psychological term of reference. Again, you know, psychology is a very Protean word, but you know, maybe we can talk about it in terms of our kind of neurotic states. Yeah. So hopefully not our psychotic states, but potentially our psychotic states. But you know, if not psychotic, then neurotic states. And at some point, we develop enough momentum in our spiritual practice to start to kind of leave some of those behind. But yeah, what I'm suggesting is actually beneath the psychological, so-called psychological level, where we as human beings tend to spend a whole lot of time, is actually a biological underpinning to how we experience the world. So Stephen Porges, who's one of the teachers on this conference, made the statement that our behaviour sits on a platform of our physiological state. Yeah? Our behaviour sits on the platform of our physiological state. And when he talks about physiology, he's particularly talking about our neurophysiology. So what's happening in our nervous system? Yeah? So specifically, if we are what he calls socially engaged, so we feel sufficiently safe and connected with other people in order for us to switch off our threat detection system and be in community, which we could say is our deepest human need and longing, yeah? To feel safe, to be around with other people that we feel safe with, and that opens up the possibility of cooperation and collective creative endeavour. I mean, I hadn't thought about it before, but it's interesting that Sangharakshita talks says that the bodhicitta, the kind of the will to enlightenment, arises in collectivity, in collective practice. So, yeah, but we have to feel safe enough in order for that to take place. So another thing he says is that pro-social behaviour, so just that capacity to be in creative communication and endeavour with other human beings, pro-social behaviour is only available if our biology is down-regulated. Okay, we'll talk a bit about down-regulation, so our physiology is either in this state of social engagement, what we call social engagement, or if we don't feel safe, we drop into what we call the mobilized state or fight and flight. People, yeah, familiar with that? The fight-flight response. So, when we go into fight and flight, we start to feed adrenaline to our nervous system. We start to feel, start to become hypervigilant. We start to feel unsettled, ill at ease, quite possibly quick to anger or despair. We may find ourselves, other people might feel, other people unusually irritating. We're probably unusually irritating to other people. So suddenly we're not giving off good vibes. Yeah? You know how it is. You can tell if you're around someone that is activated. Yeah? We can do a little exercise later on that just to flesh that out for us. So that is the step down. So we start off in this with our nervous system in a state of social engagement. If for whatever reason that doesn't feel safe, we drop down into the mobilized state, the fight-flight state, which is that's the limbic brain, our kind of mammal brain, our midbrain. Yeah, so when we're socially engaged, our neocortex, our clever brain is online. Yeah, we have the capacity for self-reflection. We start to feel threatened. We drop out of that, and we're in our chimp brain, as we call it. Yeah, so our behaviour becomes a lot more based on instinct, a lot less altruistic, a lot more reactive. Literally. Then the next and final stage, if our fight-flight adaptive repertoire, as we call it, so all the options that we have in fight-and-flight, if those fail, then we will drop down into the even older bit of our brain, the brainstem, our reptile brain, or our cockroach brain, and we start to go into freeze. Yeah, so our whole physiology slows down, we tend to withdraw inwards, and ultimately our biology goes into a sort of state of, it's called thanatosis, playing dead. So I mean, you might see this in animals, prey animals who end up in the jaws of a predator. I've seen some great, like a gazelle with its head in a lion's got its you know, around its head like this, but it's completely kind of floppy. And it's not there. And it's what's happening is actually the nervous system is getting flooded with opiates. So painkillers, analgesics. I mean, this is a nice bit of footage because actually a baboon comes along and frightens the lion and the lion disappears. And after a while, the gazelle comes back, does its shaking, which is the TRE thing that I do. The shaking like this and then runs off. And then there's a great big footage for the lion comes back and it's kind of like looking around. So that those are the three kind of levels that the nervous system will go to when we're challenged, when we're threatened. Yeah. So if someone goes into that final stage, then yeah, quite often they will be in depression, chronic fatigue, or what we used to call nervous breakdown. Yeah. So that you know we pretty much completely lose our capacity to function. Yeah. And yeah, in a way it's kind of a way of making ourselves completely helpless. So all this or these that kind of it's a gradation, it's a spectrum, of course, between this kind of what we might call a healthy state, a socially engaged state, and that state of collapse. And but we are kind of moving in and out of this this range all the time. And sometimes we can find, you know, we can end up in a threatened, in a situation where we kind of, we react very strongly to a situation, maybe to another person, quite, you know, usually it's another person, isn't it? It's usually other people who we find most difficult. And we don't always know why our kind of responses maybe kind of are as sort of charged as they actually are. But what's happened there is that we have slipped into our limbic brain, into our midbrain, and we're starting to act out from our chimp position. Yeah? Does people have a kind of sense of what we're talking about here? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Great. And the suggestion being, you know, that a lot of what we talk about as kind of our psychology, or other people, you know, we talk about other people's psychology, don't we? If you listen into people on the tube, as I often do, because you know, usually people are talking about, you know, I can't believe that this person said this to that person and didn't do this when they said that, you know, all that kind of like other people kind of disappointment, laying us down, all that stuff going on, finding other people difficult to understand. But yeah, it's actually what so much of what is actually being described there is what's happening in people's biology. Yeah, what's happening in people's nervous systems as to why they're not able to be in relationship with the people that they're working with. So there's the basic point I wanted to make this evening is that our physiological state will either bias or potentially dictate our responses to ourselves and other people. Yeah. So if we're running a lot of adrenaline and cortisol in our nervous system, we are going to be a very different kind of animal to be around than if we're in a balanced, socially engaged state, where actually what we're looking for is a situation in which we can share oxytocin, which is the love and bonding hormone. So, yeah, quite different worlds that we're talking about here. We did the Wheel of Life earlier in this series, didn't we? And we looked at those different realms. I mean, you could probably suggest that all those the six realms have a different kind of neuroendocrine immune signature to them. And those particular kind of mixes of neurotransmitters. And neuropeptides, the molecules of emotion, operating in the six realms. I haven't I haven't taken the blood test, so I'm not quite sure. But yeah, so there's a neurochemical signature. I mean, it's much more complex than that, of course, because, you know, there's such complexity to human nature. But the essential ingredients are all the same. We all kind of bake a slightly different cake. Yeah, but the ingredients are all the same. So, yeah, we've got this underlying biology. That is going to respond to threat. As human beings, or as mammals actually, our strongest drive is not, I'm afraid, towards enlightenment, but it's towards safety. Yeah? So, I mean, if you think of us as kind of cave-dwelling hunter-gatherers, which was the conditions under which, of course, most of our neurobiology developed, to be left on our own, to be left in isolation, or to not be part of a community basically puts us in life threat. Yeah, so it's essential that we remain in relationship with the people around us, because that's our best chance of surviving. Yeah. So, yeah, and also threat was you know, we were prey as well as predator in those days before we managed to eliminate our predators. So that. Our kind of instinctive threat detection system was developed under those conditions, and it still operates a lot of the time now. Yeah. Okay, so we'll remember that there's this gap between feeling and craving. Yeah, so we've again talked about that on this in this series a few times. And we've probably talked about it before. So you'll remember around the wheel there are these links, yeah, the links of conditionality. So how we bring our reality into experience, if you want to put it that way. As soon as you start using these words, it's just like, hang on. I was so pleased to hear that Rana Prabha is doing an evening course on the mind, because I was gonna start talking about we're talking about the mind here, but anyway, let's stick to the body. Not of course it's a false dichotomy. You realise that, of course. I hope you appreciate that. So here we are. We're back in the gap. And anyone remember what the gap is between? There is a gap between. That's great. Yeah. So yes. Yeah. So in the feeling and craving is the terminology that we tend to employ. So Vedana, you remember this? Feeling sensation. Yeah. And Tanha, which we actually usually translate as craving, although Rana Prabha was mentioning to me before the break, Stephen Batchelor, who some of you may have read recently, he is translating Trishna or Tanha as reactivity. So, yeah, kind of in the context of our series, that's spot on. So there's a stimulus. So stimulus and response is the kind of, you might say it's the kind of it's kind of what I think of psychologists talking about, particularly behavioural psychologists. But yeah, it works very well for our purposes. So yeah, the stimulus is Vedana, and that is what we call the first dart. Yeah, so this teaching of the two darts. Yeah, again, core teaching in the Dharma. So there's the stimulus, which we experience as either pleasant, painful, or neutral. And I love that because it's so kind of basic, isn't it? It's like, you know, we're kind of an amoeba, and there's something, you know, we either move towards something, we move away from it, or it doesn't bother us. You know? So it's just this kind of, and it's a kind of precognitive response as well. It's a somatic response. Yeah, someone walks into the room whom we love, and something, even before we've necessarily recognised that they're here, there's a change takes place in our bodies. Someone walks into the room that we don't like, or that we're frightened, afraid of. Something happens in our bodies. We then make sense of that in our head and say, ah, there's that person that I love, or there's that person who, you know, that, whatever. Yeah? But the actual shifts take place in our physiology, particularly in our gut and our heart. There was also on the conference, there was an interesting crew called HeartMath, who study a lot what they call the heart field. And they were talking about some experiments they were doing where they just did that. They got someone to sit in a room. They said, someone that you know is going to come through the door. And the heart registered, they had the heart, you know, they had the person wired up, and the heart registered the event before the door opened. So the heart is a organ of perception, as well as radiation, of course. So Vedana takes place really, really quickly. Of course, it's conditioned on our previous history, okay? But then we move into the gap. Then we're, you know, the stimulus has come in, or it's come up. You know, it can be a memory. It doesn't have to necessarily be someone else coming in. It can be something that's, you know, a memory can stir up our internal world. Or we can drop a brick on our foot or something. You know, whatever the stimulus is, there's a shift in our physiology. So then we're in the gap. If the stimulus has been a pleasant one, then obviously our tendency is going to be that we're going to move towards that. Since, you know, again, biologically our setup is to move away from pain and move towards pleasure. Pleasure in the spiritual life is interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's the whole kind of discourse around renunciation and simplification and withdrawal from the senses. There's also that kind of, the dhyanas, for instance, are intensely pleasurable states. So it's not that we're cutting ourselves off from pleasure through our spiritual practice, but we're kind of refining our pleasures. Pleasure is, you know, there are risks associated with pleasure, so kind of the tendency towards hedonism, the pleasant tendency towards addiction is kind of in there. I think if we are experiencing a lot of stress, one of the things that we've lost from our lives is a sense of pleasure. So I think quite often people actually need to be able to learn to experience pleasure again, because it's one of the things that an overwhelmed nervous system will lose. So that's pleasure. If the Vedana is painful, the tendency in a biological system is to contract, to pull away. Yeah? Does that make sense? Pain leads to contraction. Anyone like to offer an alternative? proposal to that. Okay, so I mean, pain, of course, itself is very interesting because actually, pain is an output from the brain. Yeah, pain is not an input. So, what one person experiences as pain, another person will not necessarily experience. So there is, it's individual, it's contextual. So, that's interesting. And again, there's a difference between the kind of the dropping a brick on your foot kind of pain, and then the kind of pain that comes from what we talk about is the biology of loss. So that kind of particularly what's happened to us early in our lives and how that then shapes our response to painful stimuli. So again, here we're mainly talking in the context of relationships. So yeah, when someone looks at us in that way that we associate with them not caring, we tend to sort of start to run a whole sort of interpretative story around that. The patterning for that story is often actually not about necessarily about what's happening between yourself and that person now. It's quite often about the history. So, transference, do we know this? Where we start to treat this person in the way that that they're someone from our past, not someone from our present. The tendency to kind of capitulate down to a more sort of primitive mode of operating, because maybe maybe these kind of patterns were established when we were young and less sophisticated. There's kind of relational pain. Then, of course, also, the Buddha talked about the sort of our existential pain. So, just the kind of, old age, sickness and death, of course, the three sights that sort of spurred him on to going forth. For ourselves, that kind of the difficulty in finding meaning in our lives, the kind of big questions, what are we here for? These things that maybe, I don't know, I can't speak for you, I can only speak for myself, because I kind of can sort of gnaw away at one's sense of contentment in life. So, we respond to pain by contracting. That's fine. As long as we can then bounce back out of that response and bounce back into connection, back into relationship. In terms of a creative body, we talk a lot about, we could suggest what the mark of a creative body is its capacity for resilience. And here we're talking about the nervous system, a creative nervous system is a resilient nervous system. So resilience is a buzzword in mindfulness. Resilience is about our adaptability to stress. So it's that kind of elasticity. So we can be stressed, and we can still operate under stress, but we can also, once the stress has passed, we can return. Our nervous system can come back into balance, rather than getting stuck in that state of arousal. So, adaptability to stress is the kind of that's what I would suggest is the part of the creative state. If we get stuck, we talk about a nervous system where both the brake and the accelerator are on at the same time. Yeah. So and we might feel really wired, but feel really tired at the same time. Yeah. So we've gone in. We're moving into a state of overwhelm, and there's a huge kind of cost, a huge sort of metabolic cost to keep that in that state. Requires a lot of energy, and yeah, before long we may well end up collapsing. And we can also find ourselves, we can end up in a kind of chronically, and we call it stuck in the defense response. So we're kind of the whole time we're just kind of protecting ourselves. We're not able to expand, so we're caught up in contraction. We're not able to expand, and yeah, we're running corrosive chemicals in our body that start to attack our immune system. So this is where a lot of our kind of autoimmune diseases originate from. There was one of the speakers on the conference was very clear that, you know, for him all addictions are based in early traumatic experience. So, you know, the whole kind of genetic model of addiction, he says, is wrong. I mean, you can talk about epigenetics, which itself is, you know, is interesting. But so yeah, so we're now in the kind of region. So when a body goes strongly into this reactive state, we can say that we've entered into what we could call trauma, a traumatized brain, traumatized body. Trauma is simply something which overwhelms us. So, again, you might think, oh, well, that's going to maybe be different for different people, and it is. 8 out of 10 people who have a car crash report that after 6 to 12 months later that their life is actually more meaningful because of that trauma than it was. So there's this whole, our capacity for what we call post-traumatic growth is very substantial. And yeah, you could say that that's, you know, been one of the kind of drivers in the evolutionary development of humans, is our capacity to under challenge, a nervous system, if it's able to adapt, will actually grow. Yeah, so it's what we call neurotrophic. Yeah, so the neurons grow, neuroplasticity. So that ability for the brain to kind of to rewire itself. The last one I like it as well, neuro novelty. Yeah, that the brain loves new information. Yeah, which again helps the growth, neurotrophic. It's worth remembering that the Buddha himself was traumatized. His mother died when he was 7 days old. I mentioned that I wrote this down on a piece of paper this morning. Sahananda looked at it and went, well, so was Jesus, of course. He was a bastard. I thought it was a bit strong, but yeah. You know, maybe early trauma in the lives of the great spiritual teachers of our Kalpa might be an interesting study. Then the Buddha, of course, you know, he had a lot of pleasure in his early life, but then you know, that illusion collapsed. I think probably we know the story. If we find ourselves in this state of overwhelm, we lose our capacity for executive function. So that's so this is particularly applied to kids who with ADHD or, you know, all these kind of fashionable diagnoses. But for our sakes, it's important because executive function, which is comes from our medial prefrontal cortex, is understood to be where our capacity for self-awareness at least originates or emerges out of. And let's not fall into the trap of, you know, saying different bits of the brain. But anyway, so a loss of executive function means, yeah, our capacity for mindfulness basically is going to be hugely reduced, which is why mindfulness practice is so good, because it kind of gets us back into the, it's called the mohawk of consciousness, this this lineup of neural substrates through here. But yeah, we may end up in that sort of sense of being stuck in our lives. So that sense of being stuck, or being in a spin. Yeah, so it's kind of, we just can't find a way to orient in our lives. We just seem to be going around in circles all the time. These are kind of classic symptoms of the of an overwhelmed nervous system. And the other interesting thing around it, for in terms of which might be interesting for us in terms of mindfulness, is the tendency towards dissociation when our nervous system goes into overwhelm, when our body is in a reactive state. Usually, there are difficult feelings in our body that it's hard for us to be in relationship with, so we dissociate. And there are some people who say that dissociation is epidemic in our culture. It's not an easy thing to, by its very nature, it's not an easy thing to measure, yeah? Because it's around absence. But yeah, some people would suggest that our attempts to think our way out of our problems without having contact with our embodied feelings is a dissociative condition. So yeah, if we're the kind of person who, when we sit down to do the mindfulness of breathing, all we get is just loads of mental activity, you know, that might suggest that we've lost relationship with our visceral body. Yeah, so interesting. Okay, so the creative body. For me, I think the most significant thing around what its capacity for for love, actually. And so the reactive body isn't really... it tends to be start to be just interested in self-survival. So our capacity for compassion, altruism, and what you might call romantic love, or, you know, dyadic relationships, is going to be premised on a regulated biology and nervous system. Yeah, if we want to look back at some of the difficult relationships that we've had in our past, and just kind of think back to some of the kind of crucial, difficult situations that might have come up in those relationships, you know, you might notice that there's a kind of heat there. I mean, I'm talking from my own experience here. You know, there's some kind of animal. My animal and that other animal are kind of in a difficult relationship. Yeah, so we kind of we drop out of our civilized, sophisticated relational frame. So the creative body has a capacity to be in a non-reactive relationship with another biology. I think particularly communication, I would say, is very interesting. I think communication is probably where we as humans can be maybe our most creative. I mean, I know we talk about creativity in terms of art and music and stuff on our own, which is great. But as a therapist, you know, I think and our capacity to language our experience of another person's experience in such a way as to give them meaning is that's a kind of endlessly creative context. And I love, I mean, the fact that in the when we do the 10 precepts rather than the 5, 4 of those 10 precepts are focused on creative communication. So truthful, kindly, harmonious, something else. But yeah, so a big emphasis, 4 out of 10, emphasising creative communication. Again, I mean, in terms of the creative body, it's more from my craniosacral, but also from meditation. There's something about a body that is able to come to rest, which actually, where we can start to reconnect with what we call our original health. So our kind of our blueprint of health that we carry with us from our first origins, from our kind of earliest origins, which if we are in this non-reactive body, yeah, we can start to come back into relationship with. Finally, in the context of the creative body, I suppose also for me there's the whole area of what I think of as the energy body. So chakras, I was talking to someone about a friend I know about the creative, and he said, "Oh well, it's about channeling, isn't it?" I'm not so sure about channeling, but you know, for him, you know, that we the creative body is a body that is open to a so-called higher wisdom, or you know, maybe in our language to other power. What Sangharakshita has called the supra-personal power. Maybe the creative body is less bound by this frame, more in, you know, is able to have access to something bigger than itself. So, yeah, finally, just how do we move between these states? How do we move between this this reactive and creative body? So, two phrases. First is self-regulation, and the other one is co-regulation. So, self-regulation is our ability to slow ourselves down, to come back in touch with our feelings, our vedana, our visceral experience, and to be able to be with that. So this whole area of containment. Containment, the ability to turn down stimulation when dealing with challenging situations. So, yeah, and a lot of what we teach here is obviously around self-regulation. So, you know, mindfulness is a self-regulation practice par excellence. Yeah. So, our breath is a fantastic mechanism for self-regulating, but actually just body awareness in itself, or what we call interoception. Ception means feeling, internal. So, an internal felt feeling sense is our best means of self-regulating. Co-regulation is finding ways of doing the same, but in relationship to another human being. We're not the only animals who do that, of course. You'll see other reptiles don't tend to be quite so interested. You go to the zoo, and the reptiles are in their own tanks, just kind of minding their own business, really. And, you know, you don't get a lot of kind of facial feedback expression. But if you go and check out the gerbils, they'll all be in the corner of the cage, all piled in on top of each other, right? That's co-regulation. The African hunting dogs, which you can see from the canal at London Zoo, when it's raining, they've got a big kind of bus shelter made out of logs, and they all just pile in there. There's like 25 of them just all lying on top of each other. It's fantastic. I want to jump in. They'd probably chew me minute for minute. Yeah. That kind of sense of connection with another human physiology can help to down-regulate our heart. Yeah? And in a way, it's all about the heart. There's a very fast nerve pathway between the heart and the brain. It's what we call myelinated. So it's got a fatty lining on the nerve, which means it goes faster. So the old vagus, which goes down to the gut, is unmyelinated, old. The new vagus, which connects the heart to the head, myelinated, quick. So we want to try and bring the heart back online. We could say compassion can only occur when the myelinated vagus is doing its job. And vagal pathways are portals to compassion. That's been a quick tour of the territory. I hope that's helped to flesh some of it out.